Hello, it's Friday, 4th of September. I'm Hannah Pearson from Pear Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
On this week's show, we're heading to the land down under to discuss a traumatic year for tourism in Australia.
Yes, with its borders still slammed shut, tempers are starting to fray across Australia's travel sector. But could the country be back on track, at least for domestic tourism, by Christmas? We've got the latest. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, it's 12 months since the devastating 2019 bushfires began, which caused death and destruction across Australia throughout its summer season.
And following immediately after that came the global COVID-19 pandemic, which Australia seemed to have initially under control, only for outbreaks in Melbourne and Victoria, and to some degree in New South Wales as well, to cause a political and economic panic. Hannah, so Australia's a pretty popular destination for Southeast Asian travellers and for Southeast Asians seeking a new life down under. You visited the country just before the bushfires began last year. Would you return for another visit if it weren't for COVID?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I think Perth last year, it's probably one of the best family holidays I've had. So super family friendly destination. I can't wait to go back actually with my son who's a bit older, go see the kangaroos and the koalas. Mm. What about you?
And the quokkas.
Yeah, the quokkas, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually both went to Western Australia within about two weeks of each other last year. Mm. Absolutely loved Western Australia. Hadn't been before. Been lucky enough to travel around most of the rest of the country. Yeah, absolutely, I would go back for sure. So, Hannah, before we start, let's do what we always do. Mm. Let's have a look at Australia as a destination and the statistics and what was happening just up to the end of 2019.
Yeah, well, I mean, by the end of December 2019, Australia had actually had a record year. It had 9.5 million visitor arrivals. So out of that, I mean, you can probably guess who the top two source markets were. So we've got China, who was number one, and you have New Zealand at number two. But it was really close. So China was at 1.44 million, New Zealand 1.43 million. So yeah, they're kind of competing for second place. But for Chinese visitors, they've actually had a 297% increase since 2009. But that growth has slowed down a little bit more likely. And this year is a completely different story, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a different story because of COVID, but also because of the political situation between China and Australia. We're not quite sure what would have happened there. Mm. But yeah, I mean, those two markets were leading the way by some margin last year.
And when we look at Southeast Asia is still a really important source market for Australia. So for 2019, Singapore was Australia's sixth largest market. Malaysia was Australia's 10th largest inbound market. And Indonesia was the 12th largest inbound market. So, you know, Tourism Australia are very, very active in the region in trying to encourage consumers to visit Australia, and they're strong not only with consumer campaigns but also with trade campaigns as well. So they have a very robust Aussie specialist scheme that travel agents can enroll on, and when they've you know completed certain certification, they get access to fam trips, they get access to exclusive events, and they do a lot of campaigning at the consumer fairs as well. So if we turn that around and look at it the other way, how many Australians go to Southeast Asia? Again, it's a massive market for Southeast Asia. Indonesia, as we were saying for our Bali episode, is the fourth biggest source market to Indonesia in 2019. Singapore is the fifth biggest, Thailand the 16th, Malaysia the 9th, Philippines the 6th biggest. So there is some significant volume as well from Australians visiting Southeast Asia. And so the impact of Australians not being able to visit in 2020 is going to have a huge impact on visitor arrivals.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to the point you mentioned there about Australia's proactive marketing of tourism in Southeast Asia, it has an absolutely brilliant website, I would say. It's one of the best tourism websites in the world. But that, I noticed that as also when I lived in China from 2004 to 2010. Australia was one of the first markets to really grasp that the Chinese outbound market was changing very quickly.
Yeah.
There were different niche sectors. You had to market differently to different cities. Mm. And they did that absolutely brilliantly in the 2000s. And the results from that, as you said, in the 2010s, were there was just huge growth from China. Yes.
And so pro tip, actually, for anyone looking for insights into Southeast Asia, Tourism Australia, or even the Chinese market, Tourism Australia have a fabulous section with market insights on different countries and what they're looking for destination drivers and everything else. So go check that out.
Yeah, I mean, they have their own Natural Tourism Research Institute, don't they? Which has given them a big lift up over some of the other markets, because they actually really, really do nail down quite deeply into their data and work out, you know, what the trends are going to be going forward. So that brings us kind of up to date. Now, as we mentioned there, Hannah, just before COVID, we had these terrible bushfires across Australia, which caused devastation and destruction, death, you know, millions and millions of hectares were burned during that period, which started in September last year and ran through to February this year, the whole of the summer season. But it didn't really have that big an impact on the inbound arrivals during those months.
No, not really. So when we were, you know, when we were looking at the monthly impact, it's only in February, February of this year, that we start to see a drop year on year. So February this year was minus 26%. But actually, December and January both still had positive growth. So Gary and I were saying earlier, this February 2020 down minus 26%. It's hard to say really whether that is a result of the bushfires, and some could be, but also a result of Chinese tour groups not being allowed to travel outbound anymore from January 31st, which of course would have a massive impact onto arrivals in Australia, being the top source market.
Yeah, and then of course COVID. And if we look at the impact from January onwards to where we currently are, this week Australia announced that it's officially in recession for the first time in 29 years.
Wow.
GDP contracted 7% in the second quarter, and that followed a first quarter contraction of 0.3%. So two consecutive quarters mean it's officially in recession. But the interesting thing there, I think, in terms of how looking forward to for the economy, is that spending on services fell 17.6%, which is a huge figure.
Yeah.
And the household saving rate increased from 6% to 19.8%. So Australians are clearly tightening their belt.
Yeah, holding on to the cash.
Worried about, you know, the future. They have this JobKeeper program to pay wages of companies, which has been extended until March next year.
Okay, that's good.
But the government is currently still formulating its new budget. So we don't yet know what will happen beyond that. But there is deep concern that, you know, if the JobKeeper system is curtailed in March next year, there will be huge numbers of job losses.
Yeah, I mean, and in the tourism industry alone, you know, the Tourism and Transport Forum have said for every month that interstate borders within Australia remain closed, they're losing 10 billion Aussie dollars every month.
Yeah, and the airports, I think, are losing 300 million a month as well.
Wow.
But hold that thought about interstate borders, because we'll come back to that in a minute.
We will.
Now, if we look at what actually happened during the COVID, the last 7 months of COVID, there are two or three elements that stand out. Now, Australia initially had a big surge in cases, but it then managed to cap those pretty significantly. But there were a couple of things that stood out. And obviously, one was the plague ship, the Ruby Princess, which they've just had an inquiry. This was a ship that docked in Sydney Harbour. Back in March, was it?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. And so many people were allowed to actually disembark without testing.
Yeah, exactly. It was about 2,650 people who were allowed off the ship without these mandatory checks. And they estimate that that led to 28 deaths and around 1,000 additional infection cases. And this was not just to Australia. These people were also allowed to travel internationally as well once they disembarked. So potentially spreading that transmission to other countries as well, other than just Australia.
And I mean, that's interesting that, you know, of all the people on the ship, a lot of the infected were actually crew as well. They're international crew. So that was one of the elements. And then the other one, I guess, was Virgin Australia, which went into voluntary administration to restructure the company. That airline was actually 90% of it was owned by a group of investors, which include Singapore Airlines, Etihad Airways, HNA Group from China, and Richard Branson's Virgin Group. It was carrying heavy losses going into COVID and just couldn't cope. Now, that company seems to be bought out by Bain Capital.
Yes.
Although I believe that there's actually a meeting, I think, on the September the 4th, which is
today. Yeah, I think they're deciding later today.
Today about what will actually happen. But so it's Australia's second biggest airline.
Yeah.
initially started as a low-cost carrier, but then sort of changed its format slightly. Mm. So it does all sorts of things, really.
Yeah.
But the market is, obviously, with no demand in the market, it's very difficult to turn that around until there's a clearer picture of what will happen in future.
Yeah, and I think this was really one of the first major airlines worldwide to go bankrupt as well, so early on, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Of course, others have followed suit now, but that was really the headline news at that time.
And that brings us to probably the third most important, well, it's probably the most important right now element, and that's the Melbourne quarantine issue.
Yes.
Which has sparked this huge spike in cases in Melbourne. But the story behind it is quite bizarre.
Yeah, so it seems that whilst a lot of other states were using the police to actually enforce hotel quarantines, Melbourne had decided to use a private security firm instead. And after an investigation, it seems like the private security firm weren't quite up to the job, right? So there was a lot of fraternizing between the employees. There was fraternizing between the staff and the travelers. People just not being particularly vigilant, I think.
Yeah, this was reported in the Australian media yesterday, and it's a quite astonishing story. There's an inquiry going on. But the net result is Australia currently has 26,147 cases in total. Now, 19,434 of those are in the state of Victoria. 4,091 are in the state of New South Wales and 1,128 in the state of Queensland. The rest of the states and territories have very, very minimal cases. The next highest is Western Australia with 655 cases. Mm. Now, this has sparked an issue between the different states about how they actually go forward on domestic tourism, because the international borders are closed.
Yes.
Even back in June, the tourism minister said that he couldn't foresee international borders opening this year. The Qantas CEO, Alan Joyce, has said he doesn't see that international flying will happen at any capacity until July 2021.
Yeah.
He said there may be an exception for New Zealand, and we'll come back to that in a moment with the travel bubble issue. Mm. But the issue for domestic tourism is these state border closures, and it's rumbling on and on. And today there's a national cabinet meeting between the state premiers and the prime minister.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't realise this. This is one of the things that we've learnt from COVID, is that Australia, obviously, it's a federal country.
Mm.
It has six states and I think two territories. But actually, the state premiers do not actually have any input onto national government policy until COVID. So they now have this national government where they meet to discuss issues related to COVID. And they're having one today because it started to get very, very political, particularly in Queensland, between Queensland and New South Wales, to try and forge some way forward for domestic tourism, because obviously the country is bleeding with no international tourism, but without domestic tourism,
that's it.
There's no hope for tourism businesses.
Yeah. And it's just that same issue, isn't it, that we've seen across Southeast Asia, this kind of conflict between state government and federal governments that is preventing domestic travel. We've seen it in the Philippines, for example. We're seeing it in Myanmar. When you have these kind of conflicting different agreements, things start to get very, very complicated very quickly.
And this stagnancy that's happening in the domestic travel sector, the economic impact is huge. Mm. Tourism Research Australia recently produced a report called Moving Forward, The Role of Domestic Travel in Australia's Tourism Recovery. Now, it says that the role of domestic overnight travel and day trips in Australia's $152 billion visitor economy far outweighs that of international travel. Yes. In 2019, figures showing that more than 9 million international visitors came to Australia, spending a total of $45 billion Australian dollars, with only $31 billion of this international spend reaching the Australian economy. This was overshadowed by $107 billion Australian dollars that was spent by Australian domestic overnight travellers during the same period. It was also significantly less than the $65 billion spent by Australians travelling overseas.
Yes.
The net impact of this is Australians travelling internationally spent $26 billion more overseas than overseas visitors spent in Australia.
Hmm.
And domestic travellers in Australia outspent international visitors by a ratio of more than 2-1.
Yeah, that's super interesting, isn't it? Because you, in most, at least, you know, I'm thinking about Southeast Asia again, in most Southeast Asian countries, it's the opposite, right? It's international travelers coming in that generate the most amount of money. So that's really interesting that Australia is actually domestic tourists.
Yeah, there is a caveat to this.
Tell me the but.
So, however, Tourism Research Australia noted that domestic tourists, as you would expect, have different travel and spending patterns.
Yes.
So it said the trips taken by Australians in Australia tend to be shorter.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be lower yield and they involve fewer activities than for international visitors. So that's very important for tourism businesses.
Yes.
And the average domestic overnight trip lasts for less than 4 nights and costs around $700 Australian, while typical overseas trips span 18 nights and cost $6,500 Australian.
So I guess what that means then is that it's not necessarily the same tourism companies who are being supported. So you might see, you know, activity providers who are very popular with the international market but don't get so much of a look in with the Australian market. And I would presume that's probably the case for people like local guides as well.
But the value of domestic tourism obviously is there. It's evident and it's financially so important. But we have this ongoing issue. So the primary problem is Victorian travellers because there are just so many cases there.
Yep.
What the government is saying, the Prime Minister and also the Tourism Minister is saying, that what some of the states are doing, particularly Queensland, particularly Western Australia, South Australia and Tasmania, is they're actually just issuing blanket bans.
Mm.
Now, what they want the state governors to actually put in place is a hotspot ban.
Yeah.
So basically, they can actually identify quite quickly where the hotspots are and disallow travel from those.
Yep, makes
currently,
sense.
Most governors are actually using New South Wales, Victoria, and Australia Capital Territory, including them as entire hotspots. So nobody from Victoria, nobody from New South Wales, or nobody from the Australian Capital Territory can travel over borders.
Yeah.
You know, and Victoria, I think, accounts for about a quarter of Australians' economy. Victorians are big travellers. And people travel interstate daily for work, to take kids to school, you know, these kinds of things. Now, there was an interesting move, I think, between New South Wales and Victoria that happened this week, is they extended a buffer zone. So there was a 2.5... I think it was kilometre buffer zone on each side of the border where people could travel between if they had to go shopping or go to work or whatever. They've now extended that to 50 miles or kilometres, I'm not sure. So that actually gives people a bit more of a room to move around.
Yeah.
But the big issue is the states that are simply saying they will not allow interstate travel. Yeah. Now, I think Tasmania said that its borders will remain closed until December. Right. Western Australia said its state borders may remain closed until March 2021. Queensland is the interesting issue because Queensland's Premier, Anastasia Palaszczuk, has said they want New South Wales travellers will only be readmitted, or Victorian travellers will only be readmitted if there's 28 days consecutive without community transmission.
Again, the other state
governor saying, well, that's just impossible right now. There's just no way that can happen. It's just setting a hard deadline that's impossible. There's another overlay to this as well, is that a lot of the other governors are saying that the Queensland government is using this as a political tool because she has an election on the 31st of October for re-election. So she's actually using this platform of keeping Queenslanders safe as a political tool to get re-elected.
Yeah.
The other overlay to that as well is that Queensland has just won the pitch to host the grand final, the Australian Rules Football Grand Final, which has always, historically, always been held in Victoria. Always at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. Obviously, it can't be held in Victoria this year because of the lockdown. So it was pitched out to four states that applied for this. Queensland has won that, and it'll be hosted in Brisbane 1 week before her election.
You know what? I'm getting really fed up of all of this, of just the extent to which elections are interfering with these kind of decisions. You know, and its impact on people's livelihoods just because they're afraid of reopening borders. You know, we saw it in Singapore with this delay on opening up the borders with Malaysia because they had the general election and it happened. We've seen it in other places too, and I'm fed up of it, Gary.
We did discuss this on the pod a few months ago, and we both said, you know, COVID is going to become more than a tourism issue. It's going to become more than an economic issue. It's going to become a political and a geostrategic issue, and that's what's happening.
Yep.
Even in our region where things just aren't happening, you know, there's so much closure.
Yeah.
But even opening now has become so difficult because countries can't agree. Travel bubbles or travel corridors, green lanes, because... Well, for all the political reasons that we know. But
well, that probably leads us nicely then onto travel bubbles.
Yeah.
So Australia and New Zealand were one of the first ones to introduce this whole travel bubble concept in the first place, right?
Well, I was looking into this and I didn't realise this, that they actually floated the idea at the end of April that there would possibly be a travel bubble between the two countries.
Mm.
But apparently the term emanated from New Zealand. Jacinda Ardern used this domestically in New Zealand before that. And obviously in negotiations with Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister of Australia, they actually floated this idea of actually putting together a travel bubble. Now, obviously, the situation back in April was very, very different, and Australia's situation has changed significantly during that period. So the initial idea is that Australia and New Zealand could, at some point, and they did say at the time that this wouldn't happen anytime soon.
Yeah, they did.
They could open up a travel bubble where, because both countries, one of the countries is the other country's second top inbound market, and the other country, it's the top inbound market. So you know, there's a huge flow of travel, particularly business travel between the two countries. So that was the initial idea. As things have moved on, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand said that there was a possibility that they may only just allow that bubble to happen between specific states on a state-by-state basis, simply because of Victoria's situation. Yes. At the moment, those discussions still seem to be ongoing.
Yeah, that's what they said, haven't they? On the 30th of August, they were saying it's still under plan. You never know. Something might yet come out of this by the end of the year.
And the New Zealand Trade Minister made an interesting comment also on the 30th of August. He said, "We had hoped for Australia first as a travel bubble, but because of the Victoria situation, we moved to do a deal with the Pacific Islands, where there is no community transmission. So we were going to start with the Cook Islands, but of course that has been delayed because of the cluster in Auckland." So all there's so many integrated issues about not being able to manage these travel bubbles. But, you know, obviously that's where it started, because both Australia and New Zealand are island countries.
Mm-hmm.
Conceivably, they were able to isolate themselves from the rest of the world, shut their borders down. Yep. Obviously, one of the other overlays that doesn't get mentioned too much is it's winter in both those countries right now. There's been issues with the returnees as well, of course.
Yeah. They've just announced as well recently, haven't they, that Australian citizens will not be allowed to travel out of the country until at least December the 17th. So they've extended this ban by another 3 months. By December, Australians will have not been allowed to travel overseas for almost 9 months. That's a really long time for people to be stuck there. But there's a restriction the other way as well. So there's this restriction as well on the number of overseas Australians who want to return back to Australia too. So that's capped at 4,175 passengers a week. And they also recently changed the rules as well, and saying that those passengers will also have to pay for a 14-day quarantine in a designated hotel upon their arrival as well. So it's not cheap. It's very difficult to find these flights. I've read lots of kind of heartbreaking cases where people have been bumped off flights, you know, not finding flights again for another month or so. So for those who are overseas, you know, potentially who were just stranded as tourists, it's really critical for them, isn't it?
One of the things you always find when you're dealing with Australia in any sphere is you get very forthright opinions. Mm. And even the Prime Minister said, I think it was about 2 or 3 months ago, that Australians that should return to Australia had enough time to come back. And they had to implement this cost, because so many Australians would be coming back, that, you know, if they set this time to limit, then people would actually have to pay for their own quarantine fees and those kinds of things. But, you know, but that's the interesting. And then the other thing you mentioned there, Hannah, that they've now extended until December the 17th, these restrictions on international travel and on cruise ships as well. And that falls under this horrifically named the Human Biosecurity Emergency Period Act.
It sounds like something out of E.T.
Yeah. Well, apparently this is based on the Biosecurity Act 2015, set the scenario for these kinds of things that could be happening.
Well, at least they did some preparation.
5 years ahead of time.
Well done, Australia.
But yeah, so we've got to the point now where there is simply going to be no inbound or outbound movements at all. The industry has accepted that.
Yes.
Begrudgingly.
Mm.
But the issues are domestic right now. And how they actually come to a conclusion to get people moving and get people spending.
That is really the huge challenge.
Yeah. And so, Hannah, I was looking into another issue that's quite interesting, which has emerged during this period. And I'd not really thought anything about this before. But obviously, with so many airlines putting their planes out to pasture, basically, because they can't fly, they're having to reduce their capacity down so much. There is this huge, what's called a boneyard, in the middle of Australia near Alice Springs, where planes are parked.
I've seen pictures of
this. Now, apparently, it's the first boneyard of its kind in Asia Pacific. And it is called the Asia Pacific Aircraft Storage Maintenance Facility. It's in the desert, And the reason for that is because it's got low precipitation, hot weather to reduce the chances of rust.
Mm.
Now, apparently, before that, this was set up by an Australian entrepreneur who used to work in the aviation industry. It was set up, I think, in 2014.
Yeah.
And initially, it had about 18 planes at any one time because they do need constant maintenance.
Yeah.
Now, that in recent months moved up to 44 aircraft. But recently, the Northern Territory government has said that it will invest a further $3.5 million into this facility to boost the number of planes that they're up to 100. Wow. Now, some of the airlines actually park their planes there. Obviously, the Australian airlines, so Qantas and Virgin Australia, I think, also Air New Zealand. But also Singapore Airlines, Scoot, and Iceland Air.
Iceland Air, that's a long way to go. That's really interesting. That was a smart business idea that guy made a few years ago.
Wasn't it? Yeah, foresight of that is incredible.
And that neatly leads us on really to the aviation sector in Australia. So like we were saying,
which is hurting really badly. Yeah. Currently, according to OAG figures, air capacity in Australia at the moment is minus 74.1% compared to the same week in 2019. So that's basically three quarters of air capacity has been cut out. There's obviously no international flights at all.
No.
Domestic capacity is being hindered by these state border problems.
Yeah, I mean, and Qantas have, I think they've announced around 6,000 people will need to leave the business. Last week they announced there might be another 2,500 that might need to leave. They're making losses of about 1.9 billion Aussie dollars. And like you said, Gary, they're not predicting there's going to be any international flights until July 2021.
Yeah, that financial impact on Qantas is huge. As you mentioned there, it was $1.96 billion loss in the fiscal year, which I think runs to the end of June in Australia. But you compare that to last year when they made an $840 million profit. So the actual difference between those two figures is $2.8 billion Australian dollars.
Unimaginable, isn't it?
It is unimaginable. Yeah, absolutely. And even now, it's only currently running 20% of its pre-pandemic domestic capacity.
Wow.
So it's only a fifth of the flights that it would normally operate on Australia-only routes are currently operating.
Yeah. And the CEO there, he's really leading the call, isn't he, for state borders to reopen. So he and many other industry people are kind of coming together and signing these petitions, really calling for the reopening of state borders.
There was, I think it was this week or last week, I'm not sure, there's this Save Aussie Tourism campaign. It's an open letter to the state governors.
Yeah.
And this was signed by the CEOs and the leaders of pretty much all of Australia's major travel companies and some others as well.
Yeah.
And it was a very heartfelt letter. It was very well written.
Mm.
And what they did actually acknowledge, that I read you a passage from it. It says, "We all acknowledge the seriousness of the health crisis we are experiencing. We understand the need for the current Victorian border closure. We also support the continued closure of Australia's international borders, even though many of our businesses rely on international visitors for a significant proportion of our revenue. The events of recent weeks, in particular the ongoing changes in policies around borders and access to interstate travellers, have resulted in crippling uncertainty among tourism operators and would-be travellers alike.
Mm.
Guests who had previously been prepared to postpone travel have now cancelled in light of the latest announcements on long-term border closures. Fundamentally, we have seen these decisions erode confidence in the domestic tourism product, and we foresee serious long-term damage to Australian tourism as a result." That's pretty rational. That's pretty...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, they've accepted.
Well argued.
They're not asking
is...
for international travel. They just want to be able to do a little bit of domestic travel to keep them going, don't they?
Yeah, and it finishes. This is an absolute plea to the governors, who, as we said, are meeting today. "We implore you to work quickly and collaboratively with neighbouring states to install screening protocols and to implement logistical solutions which will allow interstate travel to recommence in a safe and sustainable manner."
So, Gary, I know this week you've also been reaching out to people working in the Australian tourism industry, didn't you?
Yeah, we spoke to three experts in the hospitality, business travel and tour operator, inbound tour operator sector. And we got some really interesting feedback in terms of what's actually happening now, but most specifically about what could happen in future.
Yeah.
So there are numerous challenges obviously facing the industry. And I spoke to David Perry, who's an experienced hotel leader who's managed leading hotels in Melbourne, Sydney, as well as Singapore and Jakarta. And he said one of the problems at the moment is it's hard to imagine business as usual until COVID is under control in Australia. And only then will domestic tourism have the opportunity to rebound. That's an important point, I think. He said one of the issues now, of course, is keeping great teams of people together is harder than ever this year.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He said the hope of a vaccine is gaining strength every day, and once the world has access to a vaccine, we may well see a very strong global rebound. He adds that once a vaccine is available, the question will be what ambitious reform agenda will be embarked upon for the tourism sector. He then adds a couple of questions. Will there be changes to the terms of casual employment? Will Australia wean itself off an over-reliance on bilateral air agreements which choke international tourism growth with quotas for the number of international flights that can operate between nations? Australia has a robust open skies agreement with China, yet no open skies agreement have been made with our ASEAN neighbours.
That's interesting.
He says this has skewed our reliance on tourism growth towards China. The growth from ASEAN has been particularly strong.
Yes.
But it does need more.
Access. You need air links, exactly.
So Simon Bernardi, who's managing partner of Australia and Beyond Holidays, which is based in Docklands, Victoria, he adds on this point. He says that should there be a recovery, inbound Asian tourism will certainly drive our tourism recovery. Southeast Asian markets are key to our business. Fortunately, these markets will be the first to recover. This is because many of these markets have managed the virus with the same success as Australia and have the ability to implement protocols to enable safe travel. Many of these markets will also travel as group travelers, which will make it easier to control movement and thus safety. There is talk of opening potential travel bubbles in Australia to New Zealand, or perhaps between Singapore and Japan. This could be the first steps towards an international opening for Australia.
Yeah.
And then I spoke to John P. Storb, who's regional sales manager in Australia and New Zealand for AirPlus International. He's based in Sydney. And he makes an interesting point about the industry itself.
Yeah.
He says another challenge we face is the exodus of great talent that is leaving the travel industry, largely due to redundancies, furloughs, reduced working hours, and a lack of confidence in a short-term recovery. We need good people in this industry if we are to quickly recover from the current situation. Government support will play a vital role in this. However, the broader reopening of our economies will provide longer-term stability and the way out of this crisis. The biggest challenge is the uncertainty of how long this crisis will last. We need to instill confidence in travellers to get them travelling again and confidence in suppliers to be able to grow with increased demand.
Yeah, and I think that's a really key point about people being able to retain them. I mean, because it's not only for retaining talent, it's also for attracting new talent, you know, fresh graduates who will bring innovation with them. You can imagine right now that tourism industry is not an attractive one to look to go into. You know, if you went home and told your mum and dad, hey mum, I want to go work for an airline right now, you can bet she would say, I think you better reconsider that.
You know, that's a very, very important point. And we've said this a number of times. We just don't know how long this crisis will last.
Yeah.
But the impacts, the ongoing cumulative impacts, not just the economic impacts, you know, the actual the infrastructure of the industry are going to be things that we have to keep our eye on over the next few months. But we have quite detailed responses from Simon, from David and from John. And we'll post those on our website because they're really well worth reading. There's some great insights in there. We'll put them in the show notes.
Yes. So that brings us to the end of this week's Australia special edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. We hope you enjoyed the show, and as always, we'd love to read your feedback on what we said, or maybe we missed out. So email us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com, or contact us on Facebook at The SEA Travel Show, and look out for our daily updates and insights on LinkedIn, the Southeast Asia Travel Show, and Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, meanwhile, you can catch up with our 33 previous episodes of the Southeast Asia Travel Show and 4 editions of the Friday Rewind Show on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each platform.
So that's a wrap for this week. We'll be back next week with the usual midweek podcast plus the Friday Rewind Show. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.